Hello, you are tuned into another edition of Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. I'm your host, Tony Doman, and here on the program each and every week, I find and feature a theme relating to Appalachian culture and folk life, and then I play songs and feature stories all about that topic of choice. Well, today I've got a really wonderful program for you. I'll be speaking with my guest, Curtis Buchanan. Curtis is a Windsor chairmaker who lives in historic Jonesboro, Tennessee, and he's been making chairs for a living full-time since 1984. Back in February, I went to visit and speak with Curtis to learn all about what he does in his workshop. Each chair is made from greenwood. He gets his logs from the oak, hickory, ash, maple, and walnut trees, which are all found in the southern Appalachian Mountains, and he turns those into chairs. So today's program will be one of two episodes featuring my conversation with Curtis. So tune in next week for part two. First up, to get things started, of course, we always have some fitting music. Rockin' Chair on the Moon by Bill Haley and his Comets.
Chair on the moon. I got a rock, rock, rock chair on the moon. Oh, rock away my troubles, rock away my blues in my rocking chair on the moon. When the moon is shining, shining from above, shining on the couples all making love. You look up in the sky, see the moon riding high. You look up in the sky, see a high-flying guy. I'm sitting in a rocking chair, rocking away in my rocking chair on the moon. I got a rock, rock, rocking chair on the moon. I got a rock, rock, rocking chair on the moon. Oh, rock away my troubles, rock away my blues in my rocking chair on the moon. Sleeping in the day, haven't got a worry, haven't got a care. If I do, I lose them rocking in my rocking chair. Troubles seem to fly away, blues die away in my rocking chair on the moon. I got a rock, rock, rocking chair on the moon. I got a rock, rock, rocking chair on the moon. Oh, rock away my troubles, rock away my blues in my rocking chair on the moon.
All right, rocking chair on the moon there, Bill Haley and his Comets. Okay, folks, so today here on Mountain Song and Story, I will be airing a conversation with Curtis Buchanan, which was recorded back in February of this year. I had the great opportunity to go visit Curtis in his workshop up in Jonesboro, Tennessee, to talk all about what he does, all about chair making. So it was such a fun day and such a great opportunity to be able to go visit Curtis in his workshop and learn all about this interesting crafts. So a little bit about Curtis before we get on into our conversation. Back in 1983, Curtis met Windsor chairmaker Dave Sawyer, who was well known for sharing his knowledge of chair making. And Curtis was actually able to begin making chairs full time since 1984. And Curtis is co-founder of Greenwood, a sustainable forestry project in Latin America, and co-founder of Jonesboro's Locally Grown, a local food initiative that includes the Jonesboro Farmers Market, a yearly farm-to-table dinner, and Boone Street Market. So Curtis specializes in making a Windsor chair. A Windsor chair is named after an English town of Windsor, and the chair originated from the early 1700s. The chair is a form of wooden seating in which the back and sides consist of multiple thin turned spindles that are attached to a solid sculpted seat. Curtis has such a great outlook on life, so it was so fun to talk to him in his actual workshop, which is tucked away in his backyard in the Jonesboro Historic District. It is just fantastic, and if you ever get a chance to visit, just reach out to him. I encourage you to do so if you're interested in chair making or woodworking. So we're going to go ahead and get on into our conversation all about chair making here with Curtis Buchanan. Joining me now is Curtis Buchanan. Curtis is a Windsor chair maker and has been making chairs full time since 1984. Curtis, thank you so much for talking to me today. Welcome to the program. And thank you so much for allowing me to come and visit you and your workshop today in beautiful Jonesboro. It's such a beautiful February warm day.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tony. Thanks. Yeah.
So let's start by telling folks a little bit more about yourself. What is the full story on how you got involved in chair making? Where are you originally from, and how did you end up here in Jonesboro?
Okay.
A lot of questions.
Right. Well, Marilyn, my wife, says the way I got into chair making was she told me if this chair making thing didn't work out, I'd have to get a job, and that scared me to death. And I was a carpenter, and then I started working with a older fellow in his cabinet shop, and somewhere along the line I ran across some information on what's called greenwood working, which is working wood straight from the green log with hand tools like a draw knife and a shaving horse, and I just couldn't sleep. You know, this was just the most exciting thing ever, and so I just took off with it. And there's a few things made like that. Ladder back chairs are made like it, spoons, bowls, bows, like long bows, and pitchforks. But I chose Windsor chairs, and I've just never gotten tired of it. You know, now I'm going on almost 40 years of it, and never gotten tired. I just love it. I'm from Kingsport, and I was born there in 1952 and went to Dobbins Bennett, graduated in 1970, and went to school down in Tennessee Tech, where I got a history degree and a minor in Spanish, and met the degree's fine. I'm glad I got it, but it's where I got my wife, so that's the best thing about it. That helped me more than anything. No telling what would happen to me. How'd I get to Jonesboro? We had one child at the time, and we were living in Marion, North Carolina. Marilyn wanted neighbors. We were living out in the countryside, and she wanted neighbors. And I didn't want to move into a development. And so we realized that a small town had neighbors, and it wasn't a development. So we kind of compromised there, and which is what it's all about. And we were we looked at a bunch of little towns, a bunch of them in North Carolina. And the ones that seemed to be alive at that time during the early 80s, you know, now you got other ones like Marshall is really coming on strong and all that, but not then. But the towns were like Highlands and Blowing Rock and you know, cute towns, but they didn't seem to have families and be family oriented. They were more tourist oriented and more summer people that came up, and that wasn't what we were looking for. We were home visiting my parents and in Kingsport, and went over to the parents of a friend of mine who I knew growing up, and we were telling her this, and she goes, "Well, what you're looking for is Jonesboro." Well, I grew up in Kingsport. I knew Jonesboro. Nobody came to Jonesboro, you know. In fact, one of our comebacks was, "You want to go to the movie? Well, it's better than going to Jonesboro." You know, that's what we would say in the 60s. And I went, "Jonesboro?" And she goes, "You can need to go check it out. It's there's a lot going on." And we drove over here. We started driving down Main Street. And Marilyn, we got about halfway down the street. And Marilyn said, "This is it. This is where we'll move." And so that was 84. And it took us another year to get over here, but we moved over in 85, and it was good. You know, we live right downtown in the middle of town, so our girls were raised right down here, it was really nice. And it's nice now, but in the 80s and 90s, they were downtown all on their own, taking pottery classes or going to the theater or whatever. So and you know, it's been good to be able to walk everywhere. We, you know, love that. And you know, we've tried to get involved in town to make it better. And that's been fun, getting involved. So
yeah, Jonesboro is such a unique, beautiful gem in the middle of, like, it's just gorgeous. Every time that I come here, I'm constantly like, "Let's just stay." Well, I mean, we don't live far away, but every time I'm like, "Oh, it's such a cool, magical place," and it seems like you definitely fit right in here. I didn't realize how close you were to downtown until we pulled in, and I thought, "Wow, this is really special."
Yeah,
really,
I'm right
special
downtown.
Place.
Yeah, the courthouse clock's my clock.
Yeah.
in the summertime, the trees block it, or one tree blocks it, but I can hear the chimes and on the hours close enough.
Well, how did talk a little bit about what is a Windsor chair? So you're a chair maker, and what does that mean exactly? Is it a certain style and type of furniture that you have taken a liking to?
Yeah, so Windsors, the Windsors that we're mostly familiar with have plank seats and vertical spindles, turn legs, and a bent back, usually a loop. The bare definition of one is all the parts stop at the seat. So the legs join into the seat, tenon into the seat, and stop there. The rear legs do not go past the seat to form the back. So a post and rung chair is like a ladder back chair. You know, you make a frame, and the rear legs, the post, go up on past the seat and form the back. And I mean, you've really only got three ways to keep your butt 18 inches off the floor. I mean, really. And one of them's a Windsor chair, and one of them's a post and rung ladder back chair, and the other one is a hybrid between the two. And that's it. So yeah, that's the simple explanation, is all the parts stop at the seat. But typically they have, you know, a carved plank seat that if they're made right, it's comfortable. It's carved comfortable. And spindles in the back that go into a bent back. But there's so many different versions of them. Most of them from the 18th century. And then there was a few versions that came around in the early part of the 19th century. And then most people forgot about them. And there was factories still continued to make a few models. And then about, somewhere in the 70s, interest in them came back, interest in buying the old ones. So the problem with the old ones is they're old.
Mm.
And a chair that needs to hold up somebody that weighs a couple hundred pounds, you know, while they're having fun sitting at the dinner table drinking too much wine. And you don't want them sitting in some old chair that you just paid a bunch of money for. So it gave a market for chair makers like me. I was early on in it. There weren't too many people doing it whenever I started, but there were some. And now it's just exploded. So there's a lot of good makers out there all over the country. And really, it's even gone into other parts of the world. It went American chairs, they came from England originally, Windsors did, 1720s and 30s, the idea. And then we made ours just purely American, mainly because just different woods, but different personalities too. Now there's quite a movement in England to make American Windsors among chair makers.
That's interesting. And,
there's a lot of people in Australia making them. South Korea now, for some reason, there seems to be quite a few makers there, and a smattering around other parts of the world. But those are the main places. But yeah, it's gotten real popular now, especially for woodworkers to learn, because it can be made with very small tool investment, just a few hand tools, and then your wood is cheap because you're working from the log, not buying expensive boards that have been sawn and dried.
What's the difference, I'm wondering a little bit about the benefit of using the green wood as opposed to what you just said, like dry wood? Because in my mind, I never imagined that these chairs were made out of, like, green wood. Right. What's the...
Yeah, well, it was new to me, too, in the 80s. I thought, what is this? You're working wood straight. You can't do that. Well, yeah, you can do that, and it's been done for centuries. I mean, one advantage I just mentioned, you don't need a big power tool shop to cut this dry wood. So the wood is soft whenever it's green. So it's easy to cut with knives like my draw knife. And it's a lot of fun. There's no dust. There's all kinds of advantages.
Oh, yeah.
but also I split it out of the log. So I need good, clear, straight grain stock, in order to split it, and it'll split straight, and then I follow those long wood fibers with my knife, so the split follows the way the tree grew. So you're taking the strength the tree has to weather a storm, and you're trying to put it into this chair uncompromised, and a saw doesn't know where that goes. So now you can't put the chair together with the wood being green, but you make the parts while it's green, and then I selectively dry parts. So some of the parts in the chair are a higher moisture content. They would be what we might call air dried. So they still have a little bit of moisture in it, maybe 15% moisture, something like that, and then other parts would be super dried, and I do that in a little tiny kiln that runs off of light bulbs, and it will dry it down bone dry. And then when the chair is put together like that, one part swells, the other part shrinks, and that's what holds it together.
Wow.
Is that so? You get that advantage with working a green wood.
So there's no glue or anything that's kind of keeping the parts together. It's just how it shrinks and expands.
That's the main thing. I use glue Windsors. People have always used glue with Windsors, even going back to the 18th century, using animal hide glue, which is what I use too. But post and rung chairs, ladder back chairs, done in traditional families in the Southern Appalachians never use glue. They only use the expansion and shrinkage. Back in the 90s, I wrote an article on a bunch of families that were still making chairs that were traditional families that have been making them for generations. And I never ran across one person that was using glue, and their chairs don't come apart. Windsors are a little different, so there's some joints that would require some glue. Other joints you could get by without glue, but it's cheap and easy, so I throw it in there. We call it insurance.
I can't get from this cabin.
What cabin, joking?
I ain't going nowhere.
You ain't going nowhere.
Just let me hear grabbing.
Grabbing?
Grabbing the flies around this rocking chair.
Rocking chair.
My dear old Aunt Harriet.
Aunt Harriet.
How long in heaven you been?
Heaven you been? Oh.
Send me a sweet chariot.
Oh, chariot.
For the end of the troubles. I see,
Daddy.
Oh, rocking chair, get it.
Rocking chair, get it. Oh.
Judgment day, yes, sir.
Judgment day, hell.
Chained to my rocking chair.
How did you get started in this world of chair making? Obviously, it seems like you definitely had an apprentice whenever you were starting out. So could you talk a little bit about the journey where it all began?
Oh, gosh. Well, like I said, we were living in North Carolina, and I'd been doing carpenter work, but it was the early 80s, and there was a recession. And so there wasn't much work, and we moved into a farmhouse with, and it happened to be there's an old fellow that lived next door that we became friends with, him and his wife, and he had a shop in his backyard. He'd been a cabinet maker his whole life, making kitchen cabinets and such, but he was retired now, but he still went to a shop every day, and eventually, he didn't want help and he didn't need help. But I guess I bugged him so much that that I finally started working with him. And because I was in there working, we got along real well. And because I was in there working with him, we started taking on some furniture. And I liked the handwork. I liked cutting the dovetails and, you know, some just things that involved handwork. I didn't like the power tools. I didn't like the dust. I didn't like the noise. I didn't like any of that stuff, but I liked making the furniture. And then I picked up a book. The book was written by Drew Langsner. I think it was published in 79. So I got it about 2 years, 3 years after it was published, called Green Woodworking. It wasn't called that. It was called Country Woodcraft. He wrote another one later. It's called Green Woodworking. And it talked about working wood grain. And that's where I first, you know, saw this. And, you know, I didn't have any money for tools. I didn't have any money for fancy wood. But I saw that I could build a shaving horse. And I had a draw knife already. And I had a couple of the hand tools needed for this. And so early on, I would talk people into letting me come on their land and cut a tree down out of their forest, which is a very dangerous thing to do for one person. I think there's a couple still hung up out there somewhere.
Oh, no.
I just had to get away from it. But so I could get the wood actually for free then, just labor. And labor is one thing I had.
Yeah.
I had labor. I didn't have money. And then you know, you have to learn how to make them, which is difficult. And I lucked out. I just serendipitously met a fellow named Dave Sawyer when he was visiting down in North Carolina. He's from Vermont. And he made Windsor chairs by hand. And he started helping me out through the mail. We were writing each other. And then I went up to visit him in 84. And that's January of 84 is when I decided that I was going full time into this. And then June of 84, I went up and worked with him. So I was starting down the road to learning how to make the chair. And I'm still learning how to make the chair. But
I think you've got it figured out.
But then you got to sell them. You know, and that's always hard for the craftsperson, for the potter and the jeweler and all of that. You know, learning how to make a really high quality product is hard enough, but at least it's enjoyable and you're just obsessed with it and into it, and that in itself is feeding you. But you got to sell it to keep going.
Right.
If you don't sell it, you're going to have to get a job, and and we all know that. And so we pound that road hard. We, you know, I used to do shows. I mean, early on, I would go. I remember I did the Hickory Tuesday Garden Club show or something. It cost $10, and okay, I'll go do that. And somebody bought a chair. It's like, whoa, okay, or they ordered a chair. And and then after a few years, I was able to jury into Southern Highlands Craft Guild in Asheville. And they've got some really nice, high-quality shows. They cost. They're expensive. And they take a lot of time to do and a lot of energy. But that was where I would meet my market there. And then I go down to Nashville usually once a year and do TACA Fairs, Tennessee Association of Craft Artists is what that is. And it's in Centennial Park. So between the two Southern Highland shows and the TACA Fair, I slowly would start getting business, and after somewhere 87, 88, it didn't look like that I might sink. You know, it looked like we actually might float for a while.
Yeah.
And it's never, you know, it's always precarious, and it always changes. And you've got to watch, you know, be aware of that, and. So I hadn't done shows in a while. I haven't had to, so that's been great. Been able to pretty much sell whatever it is that I make, and then I supplemented that with teaching for for years up until COVID, and then I canceled everything, and I haven't really started back and probably won't. I turned 70 this year, and teaching's the one thing that I'll really cut back on. I might do a little bit of it, just a little, but I'll always make the chairs and I carve spoons too, so that's always fun.
Yeah, I was, you know, for artisans, it's always that challenge of making something that's marketable so you can do the thing that you love, and then and then also making a living on that. And so many artisans, it seems like musicians or anybody that's in like an artistic endeavor is constantly struggling with that. Like, do I go over here and play music all the time, or how do I pay my bills, or, you know, so... finding that market is always a challenge, it seems like, I would say. I'm wondering, how long does it take you to make a chair? And about how many do you think you, well, how many do you think you've made in your lifetime, or how many do you think you've made per year, I would say?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I don't keep up with any of those questions. I'm pretty poor about knowing how much time I've got in my chairs, or what goes into my chairs. It's never interests me, and it always seemed to work out. I always figured that if we had, at the end of the year, if we were able to pay our bills and we had a little bit of, and the savings account increased a little bit, I was doing okay, and that was my benchmark there. But I mean, now I don't make chairs like I at the speed and the volume that I did for years. But used to, when pretty much I was just a one man production chair making shop, I would make 50 chairs a year. So you're averaging one a week, and probably close to half that time is spent getting logs, sharpening tools, cleaning up the shop. So, you know, with any professional craftsperson, not only do they have to make something that's good and high quality, but what separates them from the hobbyist that is good is speed. Mm. You've got to be fast, or you're not going to make it. You know, it doesn't matter how good a product that you're making, if you can't make it really fast and keep that quality, then you're going to fail. So I was making about probably 50 a year for 20 some years, and so I guess, I don't know. Maybe I've made a couple of thousand chairs.
Yeah,
something like that. Mm-hmm.
It seems like a lot.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Now, when I look back on it, you know, when I was first starting, a couple of thousand chairs would have been unfathomable. But,
right.
Yeah.
I don't need your rocking chair. Geritol or your Medicare? Well, I still got neon in my veins. This gray hair don't mean a thing. I do my rocking on the stage. You can't put this possum in a cage. My body's old, but it ain't impaired. Chair. I ain't ready for the junkyard yet, 'cause I still feel like a new Corvette. It might take a little longer, but I'll get there. Well, I don't need your rocking chair. On in my veins. This gray hair don't mean a thing. I stage. Can't put this possum in a cage. My body's old, but it ain't impaired. Well, I don't need this rocking chair. An Eskimo needs a Frigidaire, like I need your rocking chair. My body's old, but it ain't impaired.
Well, you know it ain't impaired.
Well, I don't need your rocking chair.
You don't need no rocking chair.
My body's old, but it ain't impaired.
Yeah, we all know you ain't impaired.
I don't need your rocking chair.
I don't need your rocking chair there from George Jones. We're talking about Windsor chairs here on the program with chairmaker Curtis Buchanan, who lives in Jonesboro, Tennessee. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. And of course, I had to get another chair-related tune in here this hour. I don't know a lot of songs about any Windsor chairs, so we have to hear some rocking chair songs this hour. We got a few more rocking chair songs coming up, even though Windsor chairs are not rocking chairs. So keep that in mind since we are learning about chair making today. All right, folks, so we're going to go ahead and dive back on into my conversation with Curtis Buchanan. So what does a typical day look like for you now? You have this workshop in your backyard pretty much, and what does a typical day look like for you?
Oh, I love my day. Yeah. I always have. I always have. And I even love it more now. It's great. I used to come down to the shop at 7 because my girls would catch the bus. They were in elementary school. We'd be up and running in the morning, and I'd walk them down to catch the bus, and Marilyn would head on to work, and I would then just walk straight on down to the shop and work down here. But when I turned 60, I decided that I'd start coming down at 8. And now I'm almost 70, and when I come down at 8, Marilyn, I say, "Boy, you're getting down there early this morning." So sometimes I might not show up till 9, but we get up when we get up now, which is a little bit of a change from when it was when the girls were small, when we got up to an alarm clock. So I much prefer getting up when I get up, which is still early. And then, you know, Marilyn and I like to have a nice breakfast together. So we sit for however long we want, and then I come on down to the shop, and the very first thing I do now every day is I carve a spoon. I like to start out carving a spoon. It takes me about an hour to carve one. I love it. I love the process, and then I end up with a spoon to sell. When I get about 30 of them, I put them up on my website, and they sell and bring in a nice little income. And that's the other thing, as we were talking about craftspeople and musicians trying to make it. All of us are trying to get as many streams of income that we can get these diverse streams, whether it's CDs that the musicians are putting out, or playing gigs, or just whatever it is that they can see that they can bring some income to be able to keep doing this. And the same things with the craftspeople. So the spoons have become a nice income stream for me, along with the chairs. I sell my plans now. I have plans now drawn for 24 of my designs. And so that brings in a nice little residual, little mailbox money there. And I've got more coming on. But so I carved the spoon, and then I switched to whatever chair I'm making. Mostly what I'm making now is I've got another 25 chairs to be drawn. Mm. And so I'm always working on the next set of plans, which means that I'm building a chair to those plans. So I send rough figures and rough drawings to a draftsman, and he sends me back a proof, and I build the chair to that proof. And then I put that chair up for sale. And then I send the proof back to him, marked up, and he might send it back to me. I'm like, well, he always sends it back to me, and I might make another chair to it. So that's usually my day, is I carve the spoon, and then I turn my attention to the chair that I'm working on for the plans. I've always taken 2 hours for lunch, always have, because I love to take a nap after lunch. And years ago I started like, 3 o'clock, I'd just sit down over in a chair in my shop, and I'd fall asleep, and I'd go, I just need to just give in to this.
Yes.
And so I eat lunch, and I always go take a nap, and I'm back down to the shop around 2 most of the time. Yeah, I mean, the money pressure's off now. The girls are gone and are grown, and I can do other things if Marilyn, has something that she wants to do, if wants to go somewhere, something like that. So things are a little bit, easier now. I still need to make a living out of the shop, and probably always will. That's another thing that craftspeople and musicians and a lot of us sacrifice, is that big 401k. I don't miss it at all. I like coming down to my shop. I like having to come down here. I like that purpose. I really think I'd be lost without that purpose of coming down here and looking forward to that next project. And not only that, but I think having to bring in an income from it also is part of this motivation that's needed and is good. It gets me down here and gets me going, and it is part of our livelihood. There's I think that's another huge chasm between the hobbyist musician and a craftsperson and the one who gets their bread and butter from it. There was a psychologist that was showing some films one time of a cello player who had a stroke, and he was trying to learn how to play his cello again. And he showed this film of him struggling trying to play his cello. And he ran this study for quite a while, and it was not common, but it did happen quite often that if there was a musician, a professional musician in the class watching this, that they would pass out.
Oh wow!
And the psychologist teaching this was a piano player, and he said, I'm good. I'm a really good piano player. And he said, but that really drove home the difference. He goes, whenever it's your livelihood, it's another level.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. And it's good. It's good. It heightens the risk, and the risk is what we feed off of.
Yeah.
And, we don't want to be bored our whole life.
Exactly.
And risk is what brings that heightened life into it. So and making a living is one of the risks. There's other ones, but yeah.
train roll down. Hear that whistle blow 100 miles. If the train will ride, see my woman tomorrow night. 900 miles away from home. 900 miles away from home, the Lord knows. I've been to the east, I've been to the west. I'm going where them cherry winds don't blow. Whoa, me, whoa, Lordy, my. I'm going where them cherry winds don't blow.
I feel a trembling tingle of a sleepless night creep through my fingers, and the moon is bright. Beams of blue come flickering through my window pane, like gypsy moths that dance around a candle flame. And I wonder if you know that I never understood that although you said you'd go, until you did, I never thought you would. Moonlight used to bathe the contours of your face, and wild chestnut hair fell all around the pillowcase, and the fragrance of your flowers rest beneath my head, a sympathy bouquet left with a love that's dead. And I wonder if you know that I never understood that although you said you'd go, until you did, I never thought you would. Never thought the words you said were true. Never thought you said just what you meant. Never knew how much I needed you. Never thought you'd leave until you went. Morning comes and morning goes with no regret, and evening brings the memories I can't forget. Empty rooms that echo as I climb the stairs, and empty clothes that drape and fall on empty chairs. And I wonder if you know that I never understood that although you said you'd go, until you did, I never thought you would.
Don McLean there with Empty Chairs. And before that, we heard Ruben's Train from Chris Rodriguez and featuring Abby the Spoon Lady on The Spoons. All right, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, you can catch this program, Mountain Song and Story, every Thursday at 4 o'clock right here each and every week on Radio Bristol. You can also check out past programs if you visit the Mountain Song and Story blog page, which is found on over at listenradiobristol.org. You can see the show archives to this program and all of the wonderful shows here on Radio Bristol at listenradiobristol.org. As always, on my page, I have today's playlists and materials from today's show up there, so you can go check it out if you want to learn more about Curtis Buchanan and Windsor chair making. Also, this was part one of my interview with Curtis. I will be airing part two of our interview next week, so come on back if you want to hear some more great things that Curtis has to say. Curtis also has a website. You can find that on the blog page, and he's got a YouTube channel where he has over 120 videos showing you how to make chairs and sharpen tools and do all sorts of things, so go check it out. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. Again, my name is Tony Doman, and I will catch you right here next week.
Oh, rock away my troubles, rock away my blues in my rocking chair on the moon.